you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
It's no editing! I don't want an autonomous collective!
What the heck is a D? How come he can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. The rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
Not only go on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
So, welcome to, this is a, I'm not going to label these episodes by number, but welcome to this new episode with a different, I have a different guest here today, another leftist. Someone I consider to be radical left. Introduce myself. This is Dan Platt in Albany, New York. Introduce yourself.
I'm Nick. What should I?
Oh yeah.
What kind of bait? What are you looking for?
I asked my last guest what his journey was, like what brought him here. But for you, I suppose, give like a short background, and then I'll ask you a question that will go into what you do.
Okay, so just quick bio. I'm Nick, originally from Utica, New York. I'm a PhD in political philosophy and the philosophy of economics. I write and am a member of the Hampton Institute. I'm a member of the URPE and the SPUSA. So I'm also a member of the Union for Radical Political Economics, and I just recently joined the Socialist Party USA.
You just joined?
Just joined recently as a part of a local organizing effort. We chose SPUSA over some of the other parties because they're multi-tendency and because we're a diverse group, so we figured we might as well go with a broader organization. Yeah. Then
this was this year, so during...
this year, yeah, just recently.
And who was the presidential candidate for in that campaign?
That was Mimi Soltysik.
Mm-hmm.
Very, I thought I did a very good job. I mean, for the for a party with no money. I thought they did a really good job leveraging social media effectively, which again, for a very budget conscious organization is a must. I mean, if you can't do that, then you're not going to get your message across at all.
I'm a fan as well.
And they did a wonderful job.
Yeah. For those just joining us, I organize with the Green Party, but I do not see, these kinds of different political organizations and being in conflict. Because we do rather different things. So, it's been said that that the left, the radical left, the far left, we need our own institutions, and that includes in that list of things our own media, our own economic base, our own think tanks. How does the Hampton Institute relate to that, or does it?
Oh, I think Hampton Institute is absolutely one of the threads of the fabric, right? One of the pieces of the puzzle, whatever metaphor you prefer. Hampton Institute is a critical part of that. Hampton Institute is it's a collective. It's a sort of decentralized, consensus-based collective that, nobody gets paid. This is all volunteer. This is about building consciousness and, building revolutionary consciousness amongst the working classes so that the working class can become basically conscious of itself and eventually conscious for itself, then change society. So the Hampton Institute, I definitely think, is a very important piece of building that radical left alternative to the not only the mainstream media, but the mainstream alt-left, sort of.
Why don't you explain what the Hampton Institute does?
So the Hampton Institute is a... it's called a radical working class think tank, and it's meant to bring some, you know, intellectual muscle to analysis of issues relating to the working class, to its present, to its past, to its future, to its culture, to its politics, to, right, everything about it. It's a working class organization that, you know, or it's a revolutionary socialist organization rooted in the working class that's trying to bring, you know, revive working class intellectualism, to provide a place where, you know, the working class can bring, or, well, the phrase that we use is a Gramscian one, right? The organic intellectual. And we want to feature those people and their voices.
Say that word again?
Organic intellectual.
No, the one before it.
Gramscian.
Gramscian.
Relating to Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist.
Okay.
This
is a man.
This is a thinker who was imprisoned in Italy for a long, long time, where he wrote his, you know, prison notebooks, the big work that he's known for. You know, and his idea was that, you know, basically the working class has to develop its own.
So so we can warm up a bit, let's talk about current events, or at least one. So recently, El Presidente Fidel had passed. Why don't you start, since you probably have something more to say about it? I'll follow.
Sure.
And your feelings, or the media's reaction, though I suppose we should definitely start with our own thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's definitely was a sad day for me personally. You know, I absolutely have no reservations about saying that I admire Fidel. I think he's a great man. I think he might even be the greatest man of the 20th century. I think, you know, the achievements of the Cuban Revolution can never be understated. I think that, you know, the tremendous, tremendous achievements of the Cuban Revolution, you know, you can see what those things mean to the people when they reacted the way they did to Fidel's passing. You know, the photos from his funeral, I think, you know, speak volumes. And I don't know if anyone saw just today that, you know, Raul talked about his last wish, which was Fidel does not want to be memorialized with statues. He does not want to have streets and plazas and buildings or monuments named in his honor and, you know, likenesses of his created. So, you know,
that's certainly a different tone than
it's just
Kim Jong and the Kims.
Absolutely, and it's just
of North Korea.
To me, it's Fidel doing what he does best in his, you know, in his very last moment, and that's, you know, putting his finger in the eye of all the critics that he's had for decades, putting his finger in the eye of all the people who said Fidel Castro is a self-important dictator, that Fidel Castro only cares about Fidel Castro and making Fidel Castro comfortable. You know, this is just, you know, one more proof that Fidel Castro cares about the Cuban people. He cares about the revolution. What he cares about is the job he was able to do, the transformation he was able to achieve in the lives of everyday Cubans. You know, I think, again, to me, that speaks volumes and volumes. You know, there's a story that I think it was in the 80s. Some dissident Cubans got footage of Fidel's, you know, where he lived. And they smuggled it out of the country, got it to Miami, and they're obviously with the intent to use it for propaganda purposes. But when the film
he have five houses?
Well,
I think I saw a little BuzzFeed something about that.
Yeah.
Well,
you can judge some of that stuff in light of this, the conclusion of this story, which is to say that when the film got to Miami and people saw it, it ended up not being used because, well, it turned out Fidel didn't live nearly as opulently or lavishly as they expected. In fact, he lived simply and kind of humbly, and that if they realized that if they released this footage, it would end up hurting their cause because it would prove Fidel to be much more the man he says he is than the man the Miami Cuban exile mafia declares him to be.
I think I'll launch by saying the first time I kind of encountered Fidel wasn't Fidel at all. It was like a Twilight Zone episode where it's like, you know, a Latin American revolutionary has a mirror and the outgoing dictator, as he's taken to being, you know, to being executed, says like, you know, that mirror, it shows you who your enemies are. And basically it's all of his subordinates, his lieutenants, you know, who helped him make his, you know, revolution happen. And it kind of, the moral is, you know, you take power by force and thus you become the next dictator. And that was like my kind of the mass media kind of representation of most revolutions, that they're just replacing one terrible system with the next terrible system. And so it's not worth doing anything new. At least that's the message I got from a lot of material out there in my, you know, throughout our lifetimes. It took a lot of time and a lot of education getting, you know, from actual left-wing media, or at least left-wing perspectives, radical left-wing perspectives, that not only offhandedly would say, oh yeah, and sometimes the Cuban state does some nice things like healthcare. Well, it isn't just healthcare that they do well. They actually have a lot of direct democracy on a local level. They have a very interesting kind of, there is a mosaic of small businesses or crafts or what have you. It's not all top down. I mean, it's certainly more top down than other leftists would like. So there's criticisms, but otherwise there's still a lot of improvement. And the basic gist is the revolution was done by, you know, with a mass support for, you know, to alleviate poverty, get health care, education, and Fidel delivered on that. He kept, unlike most politicians, he kept his promises. And I listened to a talk, and I suppose if I have show notes, I'll put in the source, and because he did a talk in Troy recently, a month ago, and it was on democracy in Cuba, and he wrote a book on it because he investigated it, like, what is democracy like in Cuba? And it has a lot of things in common with here, where it's the job that no one really likes doing when you're elected. You just feel complaints and you try to solve problems, but they don't really have the good toolkit for it, because a lot of problems are solved with solidarity and community things and not government or state intervention, which is what even people in Cuba expect when there's a problem in their neighborhood. That aside, he mentioned that in the early days, there was all of these assemblies throughout Cuba. Now that we have revolution, what are we going to do? What do we want? And Fidel went from assembly to assembly, and his anecdote is that, you know, he's asking people, do you want elections? And their experience with elections was like ours. They're duopoly parties, or parties that don't really represent any differences. The parties themselves, liberal parties that represent just capitalist interest, American business interests, and so elections were always, they didn't matter. So they said, no, we don't want elections. We want healthcare and we want schools. And that's what the priority was. And then elections were added later. And I like this, like, one little meme that's been spread out that lately, that, you know, it's got the number of executions that the Castro regime has committed, and something like 300 and something. And then compares that to the number of police killings this year, which is 500 and something. And that, you know, but that's if you consider murder by police to be like a state execution, which I have, you know, I think I do. And certainly when you're on the receiving end, it certainly seems that way. Especially, you know, what's the difference between state execution and execution by cop, especially when it's kind of they're acting as these arbiter of, are you dangerous enough to let go? If it's like shooting someone in the back, or are they dangerous enough? Are they a threat to me? And that's what the state does when they execute someone. You are a threat to the state. You are a threat to society. But the society and the state are seen as anonymous when really they are. They should be seen as separate entities, much like society and markets or society and capital.
Yeah, ultimately, I just think, you know, when you really look into it, because I've read that guy's book and it's a great book, you know, it's arrogant on the part of most Americans and Westerners to think that, you know, they have a monopoly on how to, you know, do democracy properly. You know, they look down at Venezuela, and they look down at Cuba, they look down at, you know, anyone who doesn't do it the way that they do it.
And yet we complain about our elections all the time across the spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, most Americans who have never investigated Cuba, you know, one bit, you know, they're people living in glass houses throwing stones because, you know, whatever, again, as you were saying with the executions, you know, it's whatever you can criticize Cuba for, America is doing, and we're doing it bigger, we're doing it, you know, more severe. You know, people will, oh, Cuba's got political prisoners. What do you call Mumia Abu-Jamal? What do you call Leonard Peltier, right? What do you call...
Especially when Cuba's political prisoners all seem to be CIA agents.
Yeah, I mean...
Or contractors who are kind of third-party people hired by our intelligence.
You know...
Doing psyops.
You know, whatever...
Psychological operations.
You know, I certainly am not, you know, involved in this at a high level, but, you know, my hunch is that Alan Gross was not just some random nice guy who got picked on by the Cuban government working for USA.
Who's Alan Gross?
Alan Gross was the prisoner who we exchanged as part of the detente in 2014. We exchanged...
For the Alan, Cuban Five, as they're called?
We actually exchanged for two of the Cuban Five.
Two.
Five Cubans
being held...
They're being held in U.S. jail. They were all serving life sentences for allegedly, you know, participating in, you know, terrorist espionage. And, you know, ultimately what they were really there for were spotting, you know, the planes being used by, you know, dissident Cubans being fostered by the United and funded and armed by the United States from launching terrorist raids on Cuba by planes. So they were taking monitoring takeoffs, and the U.S. government alleged that they were spying on military warplanes and called it, you know, made a whole incident out of it, or, you know, sent all five of them to jail for life. And again, so as part of the detente in 2014, we exchanged some prisoners, and Mr. Gross was the prisoner America got in return.
Held by the Cuban government. But as you're saying, he wasn't Mr. Innocent, just got swept up.
Yeah.
He was doing some shady
things. He was bringing... illegal. He was bringing in telecommunications equipment to set up internet access for a Jewish community in Cuba. But he was bringing in communications equipment without telling the Cuban government, communications equipment which the Cuban government has decided, you know, it is not legal.
And let's go into why, you know, because the liberal press would say, you know, Cubans have a human right to broadband internet. And since the Cuban government can't supply it, well, why would that be? Would this machinery he was bringing in, would it be not allowed under the embargo?
Oh, no, it would not be allowed under the embargo at all. You couldn't, no, absolutely not. Cuba couldn't buy this.
That's what makes it illegal, not just that Cuba doesn't want the internet.
Well, it's not about the internet. It is about this particular, because Cuba has the internet. It's hooked up primarily through Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
But this would be through a satellite connection independent of the government.
Yeah.
And so what, of course, the liberal press would say is, well, of course the Cubans have the right to access the internet independent of the government, right? But of course, you know, this is not as black and white as sort of the liberal press makes it out, because of course anytime Cuba opens itself up, what comes pouring in but CIA propaganda? So you'll remember also from 2014... The Zunzuneo scandal, where it came out that U.S. intelligence services were using using text messages on cell phones, which are becoming increasingly common in Cuba, especially amongst younger Cubans, to spread anti-regime propaganda through text message. And so, of course, for the Cuban government, what Mr. Gross is doing is creating a portal through which propaganda, sponsored by the U.S., which has been there since day one, whether it's, you know, the Radio Free America, well, not Radio Free America, I forget what they called it, you know, but then, you know, we were launching radio broadcasts, propaganda broadcasts into Cuba, and then it was TV, and it was like, you know, Jose Marti TV at one point. I mean, these things have had different names.
Now, can you know, explain throughout. In so many words, and I can do so as well, but from you, why this is bad? Like, why is this propaganda, like, you know, wouldn't it be the truth about how terrible, you know, and, you know, shouldn't Cubans have access to know what they could have if they just overthrew their government?
I'll give you two examples, both of which are sandwiched around the Cuban Revolution, which I think justifies, or I should say vindicates, the caution displayed by the Cuban Revolution. One is the 1954 overthrow of the Arbenz regime in Guatemala, in which the government did not do as the Cubans did not censor its press, and did not restrict information. And what came in? Well, a whole tidal wave of CIA propaganda and agitation, and eventually the overthrow of the regime.
The democratically elected
Arbenz regime.
Kind of important to say that. And that this government was simply going to be socialistic or socialist leaning.
Yes, of course, especially in the context of...
Latin, or even not even socialist, but just not play...
But just not a United States government-sponsored...
Patsy.
Yeah, a propped-up dictatorship that we put in place for our own purposes. This was a popular regime that had been elected democratically and was overthrown by the CIA because it was socialist.
For more on this, by the way, I'll point out that Oliver Stone's kind of mini-series, like The Untold History of America, is actually really good. In giving they're 40-minute episodes and there's 13 of them. And for someone who doesn't have any knowledge of the cons of America or the history of negative things that we've done over American history, it's especially the 20th century, its focus is mostly the 20th century. It's a very good primer, meaning... It has all the essential timeline of things that we did in the 40s, 50s, that is counter to the narrative you probably heard in school that didn't sound right to you, maybe, or it was too fluffy, it wasn't real enough, it didn't have anything to do with your actual life, so you likely didn't care. And so people don't care about history because it's told in this fluffy way, which doesn't interact or it doesn't seem to be connected to the way our lives currently are. And I became quite the history nerd only when I encountered information that I could relate to how things really are, which is a Marxian kind of thing, the care about the concrete conditions of how things are. And that's what a lot of history doesn't do, because it focuses on the message that, say, the people writing the textbook, whether they be conservative or liberal, what have you, they have a certain narrative they want to project about America rather than just talking about things that happened and then letting students and teachers have the discussion of what it means. That's something we could do about Cuba specifically, which is kind of what we're doing.
Yeah, the true history of U.S.-Cuba relations is, I think, fair to say, for the vast majority of Americans, almost entirely unknown. Very few of them know that the United States conducted chemical and biological warfare against Cuba, that the United States sponsored...
When was that?
That was in the 60s, mm-hmm. that we conducted and sponsored terrorist raids, bombings of nightclubs, theaters, restaurants, etc., against Cuba.
Funding terrorists inside.
We funded, armed, trained, and recruited dissident Cubans. The same Cubans who we helped to flee Cuba after the revolution. The same people who we had helped secure in place as the torturers and cops and thugs and murderers of the Batista regime. Mm. A regime noted for its brutality and cruelty, even by the standards of U.S.-sponsored Latin American regimes.
Yeah, it's not mentioned enough, even in left-wing press, that, like, you know, or at least only in left-wing press, particularly, that the Cuban exiles, the Cubans that live in America, are the well-off Cubans that were already professionals, and that's why they were able to build their own wealth fairly quickly. They didn't start, these weren't the poor, dejected Cubans.
Yeah. Not only were they not poor, but they also got a shitload of help from the U.S. government.
Yeah.
Precisely because we had been so hand in glove with many of them as the functionaries of the Batista regime.
Very important to know. Would you like to move on? Okay. So on to my next, our next segment, this is a new thing that I'm going to try and try to have one of these every episode, is kind of cover. So one of the things I want the show to do is also have, to not, to, this is a purely educational forum. And one thing I want to educate people on is economics 101. And not the kind of neoclassical thing that's usually given in schools, if it's ever taught at all. But to talk in general terms about our economy, how it works, and what are its problems, so we can talk about solutions in other sections of the show. So, from an economist named David Harvey, he wrote a book in the last few years called The Contradictions of Capital, where he lists 17 contradictions of capital. And this is not capitalism, meaning our economic system, but capital, the fact that, you know, the money that is accumulated to do other things with, not the money that we exchange day to day. One of the things that I see in many debates and discussions between our peer group or any peer group is that capitalism is seen as just either being the exchange of money, the existence of a market in any sense. And these are mistakes, intellectual or otherwise. So the first, so he goes through contradictions of capital. There are also cultural ones, but that's for another day. Contradictions. But this is a foundational one. And so this is the first one he lists, called use value and exchange value. And this is kind of goes to that there's the value of something, which is how much it took to get, and its labor, the physical value of it. So, like, you know, pencil's value is, you know, can be literally seen as a dime, but it could be sold for a dollar, and that's the exchange value. So there's the value that something has in its physical or practical use, and then there's the value that something has in the marketplace, meaning the price that people are willing to pay for it, which is not always what people are able to pay for it. Housing being an example, that there is the value of a house based on the fact that everyone should have a right to it, or everyone needs it. But then there's the exchange value of the house, which then allows for speculation. It's that what you can sell a house for, which leads to house flipping and treating housing as a commodity, or rather something to be bought and sold on a marketplace and not something that needs to be provided to people, everyone. So what do you know about the contradiction of use value, exchange value, or, you know, what do you know about it?
Well, to add? So understand use value, right? I think you're right to point to the practical utility of an item or object. So, you know, the use value of a pencil is that it writes, right? You wouldn't quantify a use value, or you wouldn't put a price on a use value, because use value is actually beyond price, right? The use value of a house is the right warmth and dryness and shelter that it,
to be more striking, it's provides. Like putting a price on love, or the price on a child, you know, put a price on an actual human being.
Well, somewhat different, right? I mean, you can think of children as having use values. I mean, that you might morally find that
certainly families
slippery if you're, you know, depending on your persuasion. But you know, the idea of a use value is that, you know, tools, you know, have use values. You know, objects, you know, grass, for example, could be said to have a use value if, you know, in the context of an economy where, you know, we stuff our pillows with it, you know, for example, right? So a use value really is what a thing is good for, you know, what you can really practically do it, you know.
What is a lawn good for?
Do you live in it? Do you sleep on it? Do you eat it? Is it for nourishment? Do you hunt with it? Do you, you know, create cultural...
Does it give us pleasure?
...objects with it, right? So... you know, a pencil, for example, right, is useful in creating cultural objects, be they, you know, little doodles and sketches, or, you know, writing out long essays and disquisitions about, you know, the metaphysics of something terribly
or literature, abstruse. Whether it be dime store, you know, cheap
simple
romance
haiku or a body love poem, what have you. Right, but exchange value, right? So the important thing about use value is that use value is tied to a concrete function, a concrete relationship between people, between human beings, between human beings and their environment, between individuals and their communities. So all these different relationships are at play in creating a use value, creating a system wherein, you know, objects have a use value. An exchange value, as you were saying, right, is a function of there being a market. It's a function of a different set of social relationships between people in their communities, between people in their environment, where, as you were saying, something's value is sort of really an indeterminate question.
It becomes relative.
It becomes entirely relative, exactly, to what someone is willing to pay for it, to the point where, you know, not only are sort of is it possible for, you know, the prices of essential commodities to have wild variations between their use value and their exchange value, right? Where we can only equate the two under Marx's, well, sorry, again, not even Marx's, under the labor theory of value, where, right, value is really a product of hours of labor inputted, you know, into each commodity.
Would an easier example to understand be that of a piece of media or piece of culture where, like, say, a figurine, an action figure, which its practical value or its physical value is that, like, it took 50 cents to make this toy, but it's being sold for $20, and to the right collector, it's $100.
Sure. I mean, it's a good simplistic example of what we're talking about, right? You have essentially a bit of sculpted plastic in the likeness of some cultural icon, right? The value of the plastic on the market is, $2, $3, whatever you want, $10, doesn't, you know, it's an arbitrary amount, X. And then, then right there ahead is an exchange value. An exchange value is ultimately about the subjective appraisal of the utility or desirability of some commodity in a market by any and all of the various consumers who are out there. So essentially, you can think of exchange value as someone putting their item for sale on a pedestal. Everyone in society walks by, gives it a score from 1 to 10. The quote-unquote right free market averages all those scores. And that kind of becomes...
That survey sounds a lot more democratic than what usually happens,
This is sort of the theoretical account of sort of how pro-free market economists would describe this process.
Right. So this is the classical economists' way of describing
it. This is sort of the most charitable way for them to describe this process. Right. Is as everyone's sort of looking...
Usually there's an assumption that some democratic process is occurring like that survey.
Sure.
Which, because, in fact, because doesn't remember, actually happen.
If you go back to Adam Smith, in Smith's theory, consumers are sovereign, right? Consumers are in charge of the market economy.
Adam Smith was the Enlightenment economist, creator of classical capitalist economics, or at least the foundation of it.
In his, seminal On the Wealth of Nations, 1776. Excuse me.
Was that an important year?
For two reasons, yes, actually. In fact, many people, they look at the sort of parallels between that and the American Revolution, as sort of a basis for creating this sort of antinomy between capitalism and democracy, which, of course, grows wider after the French Revolution. But yeah, again, I think you should think of exchange value as... Yeah, as you said, sort of the average auction price, of all the bids in an auction of something where, it usually will, and it goes to the highest bidder.
That's the theoretical assumption. But anyway, we explained the difference between use and exchange value, at least in so many words. Let's go into why this is a problem or why there is a conflict there. So the problem I see is that I've said a few times already that it's not actually democratic how exchange value is derived. It's not done by survey. It's not actually done by asking all the customers in the neighborhood or any market that you might have. Market meaning region, country, world. But it's divided by either marketers or what I could refer to as capitalist planners. That the financiers and the finance sector on Wall Street, the people who are, you know, do stock exchange things, are making decisions which affect the price of things. And then there's the conflict that what people are willing to pay or what people are able to pay does not match people's actual needs. This is kind of related to kind of a phrase that I'm developing where everyone wants a job. Everyone, you know, sees a job as being the guarantee of economic security. But it kind of isn't, regardless of what the wage is, regardless of how strong unions are or what kind of government state protections there are. People want their job and they think they can get it with the left-right politicians, i.e. Trump or Obama even. But I would, you know, say like the goal is to get everyone a job, and this goes from, you know, our progressive Democrats on down. Shouldn't the goal be to get people economic security, the things they need, and then some? And this conflicts with the exchange. You know, do you think that's the case? And if not, explain why you think there's a what are the problems with this conflict between there's a use value and exchange value.
So I think it's important to, especially again, whenever you're talking about markets and economics, it's important to distinguish the ideal theoretical case from the practical empirical case. So there's how it's supposed to actually work in theory, and there's how, yeah, the actual practice of our actual institutions works.
Right, the Freakonomics approach.
So in theory, right, There's a problem in that sort of anything, because again, this is what Keynes would have called.
And who was Keynes?
John Maynard Keynes, the sort of the great 20th century saver of capitalism, the theorizer of the theorizer of the Great Depression.
You could say he's the next step, at least as far as the century goes.
He's the sort of the main liberal economist of the 20th century.
Gotcha. Okay, good. Continue. You academics.
So we're talking about the idea. Talking about the ideal case.
Oh yeah, the ideal and the
and in practice, and the right? So in theory, what happens really is that anything can become valuable, right? Anything at all based on people's what Keynes calls the animal spirit. So your own psychological perceptions, right? So and this is what's at play in a very famous incident that, you know, not everyone knows about. It's called the Tulip Mania. This is, you know, in the 17th century, one of the very first instances of what comes to be known as a speculative bubble. And in this mania, in this episode of economic...
Like the housing.
Irrationality, just like the housing bubble. Although this is more irrational, right? Because at least houses, right? Houses have a use value, which far outstrips the use value of tulip bulbs.
And the gardens that they can occupy.
But of course, these people started to perceive them as increasingly more desirable, and so the prices of them escalated, right, as each person bid up the price, etc., until eventually the whole thing falls apart.
And created a recession in 400 years ago.
It's just one sort of, you know, it's just sort of one point, right, is that really value is in part it's part derived from subjective valuations that come from consumers of objects and goods.
For a more modern example, we can talk diamonds. That diamonds were as industrial product very useful, but as when sold as jewelry, diamonds are in fact very valueless. But their value on the marketplace was created whole cloth by marketing.
Well, where the divergence between use value and exchange value creates systemic problem is in a different area. Where this becomes really problematic is in the fact that, right, remember, a market economy is always the motor of a market economy is spending. Spending is because, remember, there's a fundamental identity in all market economics between income and spending. right? Your spending is the vendor's income, right?
Mm-hmm.
The organization's expenditure, right, is your wages, right? So that it's all these things have a dual aspect.
There's a give and take. It's also important, I think I'll point out, that with the left or progressives of any type will decry supply-side economics, but it's actually very rare they actually talk in a strong way about demand-side economics, which is what you're referencing.
So essentially, basically, spending is the motor. Spending makes it all work. Spending, and again, this is Keynes' big insight, spending is what creates the multiplier effect. Spending creates the ripples that generate additional hiring, that generate investment and expansion and growth, etc. And so again, this is the
holy grail, economic growth.
The theoretical, anyway, account.
Mm.
And so...
Spending
is the motor. But ultimately, remember, a market is essentially a kind, at the macro level, it's a kind of auction where the theory goes that, well, whoever bids, we put everything up for auction, whoever bids the most is the person who wants it most, assuming that whoever wants it most is the person who's likely to put it to the most productive overall use, right? That's, of course,
big
just
range.
Just the theory, right? So what happens, just like any other, is it the case that for any real auction, everyone who goes has equal amounts of money? No.
No.
Well, what happens in an auction where, right, there's
one millionaire and everyone else has
chasm,
a chasm,
yeah, of inequality? Well, it means that the rich people buy up whatever they want in the first auction. Now, imagine...
Those that start now, with...
But imagine the economy advantage. As a series of auctions.
All where, the time, where every day.
The lineup of things to be auctioned off changes based on the preference, based on basically what sold the previous day. Well, you can see the systemic bias here, right? Because exchange value can be skewed by basically how much purchasing power a consumer can put behind their preferences, the lineup of the auction items, right, as you get into auction N plus 1, N plus 2, N plus 3, etc., the further down that line you go, the more and more warped, you might say, the lineup becomes as the tastes and preferences of the highest spenders, right, are increasingly reflected in the auction offerings, right, based on the, quote, rational self-interest of the people who are offering auction items, right, who want to get the best return, and so they offer the things...
Which itself is not a democratic process.
Right, exactly. So there's no democratic input.
What's offered is based on people's
individual... And so this is basically, right, a thoroughly undemocratic... Like, this is essentially how you can understand, you know, the process of price formation in a capitalist economy. You know.
So I think a takeaway, and I also want to clarify that that N plus one thing, the term you're using, is just a way of saying the next day and the next day, right?
Yeah, it's a math. Okay.
It's mathematical, but thing. I just want to put in easy, simpler terms. Let's see. So yeah, one takeaway is this is how markets perpetuate inequality by their very
and this
nature.
Is again, but I think it's important to point out. This, yeah, by their very nature, that's the critical phrase, that this is not something that is accidental. This is not a crony capital.
It's not
whatever.
Something that can be even regulated.
Exactly. This cannot be. This is how a market works. It is attuned. A market is attuned only to purchasing power. And so if and when you have vast discrepancies in the amounts of purchasing power actors can bring, the market is going to respond disproportionately to the people who have money to spend, and it's going to supply them with what they want, whether what they want is environmentally good, whether it's good for the community, whether it's good for them physically, right? If people, right, people want crack, so there's a healthy supply of crack. Right, whether it's good for them or not, and again, manifestly,
and regardless of the regulations, making it legal, having enforcement, it took a lot of community action on the part of a lot of given people to make a dent in the negative consequences of that.
Yeah, so I mean, it just
and it wasn't police action that caused
this. Is one of
the
things that I like to point out when, you know, especially when talking to liberals, when talking to people who think, you know, oh well, we'll regulate that. well, you know, we'll put some laws in place and we'll make that they can't do that. These are markets have systematic, fundamental, baked in problems. Problems that are not solvable except by the elimination of markets and being their replacement by planning through a democratic planning process. You know, there are different ways to do price formation that are democratic, that are participatory, and that are no less efficient and no more difficult.
I think that's a good thing to end on there. Not completely, but just that section. That was good stuff. So let's change some gears, change tracks towards a more social slash, but still talking about, and I also like talking about language and the terms we use and understanding. So like we used a lot of different terms in that last discussion to talk about base economic problems and how the usual set of answers from the establishment do not work, if not by design, but because of very serious mistakes that they are making in using these vast assumptions and that they're not really seeing these, there's a denial of these deep problems. So to change tracks, I have a piece from, it was published in Truthout, I believe. I don't have its writer listed. Will be a reaction to a lot of think pieces that I've been seeing in a conversation, a worthwhile conversation in public about the alt-right or neo-Nazis and whether it's important to call one or another. Those that take in mass media or mainstream media will say it's important to say a spade is a spade. These alt-right are all neo-Nazis and so on. And or there'll be some nuance and say, well, it is all about white supremacy. So from there, I'm going to read some this piece, and we can and you can give and you feel free to jump in at any time. And I like this as a good breakdown of it's the problem with saying that they're all just one thing, and that alt-right is a useful term, especially when it comes to understanding who our enemy is. Saying we shouldn't call them alt-right is saying that we don't need to understand our enemy. It's like a conservative in 1969 looking at the new left, spanning from Alinskyites, Saul Alinsky, to Yippies, which are, as defined, hippies that have been beaten up by a cop, from clean for Gene canvassers to the Weathermen. Saying this new left label is just a ploy to hide their subversive agenda. They're all just communists. That's all we need to know, and all these petty differences are just a distraction. Unquote. This kind of attitude only benefits your opponents. Here are some distinctive features of the alt-right that I believe anti-fascists, like ourselves, and like those that rallied in Albany yesterday, should take into consideration. So they're not numbered, but I'll just do so. Number one, the alt-right is strong in online tactics, social media, and all the types of things they did during the last year, but weak in on-the-ground organization. But the alt-right is the first far-right current that exists mainly online. Alt-rightists have successfully used online memes such as Cuckservative and hashtag DraftOurDaughters as propaganda tools to shape mainstream discourse. They have also turned online harassment and abuse into a potent tactic for frightening and silencing opponents. On the flip side, alt-rightists have little formal organization and very limited capacity to muster supporters for in-person rallies or other events. This could change, as some alt-rightists, such as the Traditionalist Youth Network or Traditionalist Workers' Party, these are organizations formed in the last few years, are actively building bridges with older school white supremacist groups, in part to help increase their physical presence, like on campuses. Here's number two. The alt-right brings together different branches of white nationalism. So that is a current that is across the board. Some alt-rightists embrace neo-Nazi ideology. Others emphasize a pseudoscientific race realism that's heavy on IQ stats and genetics. A third major current, so thus they give themselves this scientific credibility because science is so important. Especially in liberal currents, science is always, and rationality is seen as the first value you need to have. I'm not always on board with that. A third major current borrows from the European New Right, which has reworked fascist ideology using concepts borrowed from progressive movements, such as cultural diversity and identity politics. There's overlap between these currents, and despite some infighting, the alt-right has so far succeeded in maintaining a big tent approach and avoiding the sectarian splits that have stymied many earlier far-right initiatives. But ideological differences could be a point of vulnerability. Number three. The alt-right encompasses rightist ideologies that don't center on race. White nationalism has been the alt-right center of gravity, but the movement also overlaps with other political currents, including the so-called manosphere, an internet subculture of men's rights activists, MRAs as they're called, pickup artists. These are men that kind of make a hobby out of trying to trick women into sleeping with them. And others focus on destroying feminism and re-intensifying men's dominance over women. There's also the neo-reactionary movement, also known as the Dark Enlightenment, a network of authoritarian intellectuals who regard popular sovereignty as a major threat to civilization. There are right-wing anarchists, like a man named Keith Preston's Attack the System, which blends opposition to big states with a kind of Nietzschean elitism. They are for segregation and things like that, but not racial segregation, but ideological segregation. There's also a man named Jack Donovan and his male tribalism, which envisions a system of patriarchy based on close-knit gangs of warrior men. And the last two mention, two men by name, because like online culture, there are these men who have these cults of personality. In fact, one is actually called the Cult of Dusty. And he's a new atheist. But I made this joke recently that, to myself at least, that new atheism is like the gateway to the alt-right. These currents have significantly influenced alt-right goals, tactics, forms of organization, and political targets. They also have helped the alt-right reach out to people who may not be white supremacists, and may not even be white. This capacity to extend its reach is part of what makes the alt-right dangerous. But there has also been conflict. For example, some are rightists dismissing neo-reaction founder Curtis Yarvin as a Jew, or denouncing Manosphere icon and would-be ally Darish Valides, or Rushvi, as a greasy Iranian who defiles white women. Next point. The alt-right is internally divided about how to deal with Jews and gay men. Anti-Semitism is standard across the alt-right, but it takes different forms. Neo-Nazis within the alt-right regard Jews as the ultimate embodiment of evil, who must be completely excluded from the movement and from any white homeland. But other alt-rightists want to ally with right-wing Jews against Muslims and regard Israel as a healthy outlet to keep Jews from subverting white society. And some alt-rightists, notably American Renaissance, one of the movement's core institutions, welcome Jews as speakers and writers and as participants in a future white homeland. Similarly, white many alt-rightists want to suppress homosexuality. Others denounce homophobia as a divisive force that weakens white solidarity and the male bonding needed for civilization to flourish. Notice a theme here, that identity politics divides the alt-right up into sections as much as the left. Next point. The alt-right is overwhelmingly male. This reflects the movement's patriarchal politics, of course, but also the boys club character of the online networks that furnish the bulk of its recruits, as well as alt-right's general refusal to address women's interests or concerns in any significant way. By contrast, the equally misogynistic biblical patriarchy movement has far more female participants and activists, because it at least offers women a sense of belonging and recognition, however distorted. A patriarchal family can't exist without women, but even this kind of family is peripheral or irrelevant to male tribalism and large swaths of the so-called manosphere. some of the groups in Manosphere include men going their own way. And I think this is it. Yes, this is it. Last point. Most of the alt-right regards Donald Trump as a useful stepping stone. Most alt-right has supported Trump's presidential campaign and were thrilled by his upset victories over both the GOP establishment and HRC Hillary Clinton. But they don't think Trump shares their politics or will bring about the white ethno-state they want. Rather, they believe a Trump presidency will give them more space to peddle their ideology and move the Overton window. The alt-right's relationship with Donald Trump has been tremendously beneficial to both parties, but it could also turn sour in any number of ways. Even as he ramps up authoritarianism, Trump will have to navigate between the alt-right and other players. Above all, an economic ruling class whose majority did not want him to be elected.
On the alt-right in general, I mean, there's, a fair bit of that is pretty right on. I mean, yeah, it is divided. Some of it is more dangerous than others. I mean, I don't know what the, I mean, yeah, it's always better to note with nuance the differences between your opponents. But, I mean, but they're all to be condemned. I mean, the entire alt-right is a horror show of different deplorables and rejects.
I think it helps in knowing how to condemn them, because to condemn with a broad brush, like just saying they're racist, is...
Yeah. Well, look,
it's something I learned in the atheist movement, that you have all these different types of religious people, and they all have different ways of viewing their religion. And their views of God and the rules that they follow and morality. And depending on, like, if you're going to debate one or if you're going to debate one in the public space with an audience, then it matters. For example, some of the Manosphere is like the Gamergate phenomenon, and which was like a lot of these men feel, like many others, that something has been taken away from them, particularly privilege. Privileges and advantages that this economy does not give them. There was a thing called Angry Jack. It was a video series that explained Gamergate and how they've lost their innocence because some feminist social justice warrior or leftist told them that the world isn't black and white. There's grays, and you're in it. You're in that gray. And they don't like it because now they have to think about it. Now they have to, they're told, your lifestyle is in fact harming people. And it's not just, white male, but even like you're progressive, you're liberal, you're progressive. You tell them that, like, you're not concentrating on the big picture and the systematic problems, and they go into denial mode. And they want to just focus on the identity politics of the day, what Trump just tweeted.
Sure. I just, it's great, from a sociological perspective, I suppose, to draw these distinctions between segments of the alt-right. I mean, ultimately, for me, the distinction is between ultimately harmless douches and militant, dangerous fascists. And yeah, I mean, from that point of view, yeah, it's definitely to know which is which, And ultimately, the men's rights people are, most of them, harmless douches. They're not. It's the neo-Nazis who are more dangerous. And even the sort of race realists. They're people who are naive enough to think that, you could separate the races in this country in a peaceable fashion. That it wouldn't be. Just look at the partition of India and Pakistan, which is, would be a pretty good, I think, historical precedent for trying to separate, black and white Americans
and resolve those
in this race realist sort of
conflicts. And that was more by religion.
Yeah, and this would be just as wrenching and just as bad. I mean, there's no...
But for the context, a lot of people died.
A lot.
Not to mention just separating families and the emotional cost, but there was also a blood cost.
Huge, huge loss of life. The same with the exchange of the Greek and Turkish populations, at the end of World War I. So
that was a whole war involved too with that.
So, it's just these people, you know, again, like, I think the pickup artists, you know, the men going their own way, you know, these are just jaded losers, yeah, who are sore about...
They're not political movements.
Losing what, yeah, losing their male privilege. And, you know, maybe some of them also do happen to actually be racist. Other ones, you know, maybe are just casually racist like the rest of society and are really not, you know, terribly invested in, you know, or consciously, right, invested in white supremacy. They're much more interested in male supremacy. And that's, you know, objectionable on its own ground. So, right, we shouldn't call them all racist because, right, some of the men's rights folks are just sexist or just xenophobes. But yeah, they're all to be condemned. I mean, they're not all alt-right, but...
And sometimes they're separate fights. But where it gets into real life, or, you know, like in recent news, this wave of kind of hate crimes, whether it be vandalism, whether it be actually somebody shouting Trump and ripping a woman's hijab off, those are probably under the dangerous category. But then there's all, like, there's vandalism, there's people putting up flyers, and I kind of wonder to myself, like, are these just bros trying to get a rise out of people in their own, like when they punk people, or not punk,
well, look,
I mean,
it depends.
When they do pranks on people, it's like the scary clown phenomenon. There's no punchline, sure. It's usually at someone else's expense, and there's no kind of catharsis for both sides. It's just somebody laughing at someone else for feeling pain, emotional or otherwise.
I don't know. I think if you know,
I wonder how many of this bullshit is that.
We had an incident here in Albany where the SUNY Albany dorms were vandalized with pro-Trump, neo-Nazi graffiti.
Yeah, just a swastika, or was it?
Just a swastika. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was more. It was a swastika and, you know, Trump.
Right? But we know they weren't Buddhists. Do you think these are the guys we should worry about?
Oh, these are not. I mean, I do think some people. I mean, there are these bros out there. Although I think there's a difference between the scary clown thing. You know, when you write Trump on the wall, when you paint a swastika, you know, it's a dark sense of humor. To put it mildly, you know, that would do that as, you know, and not intend any kind of ominous, threatening racial message by it. You know, the scary clown thing is like a thing that douchey frat bros do because, ha ha ha, they think it's funny to scare somebody.
It's not the same psychology, and
I'm not saying that we will never see an incident of, you know, frat bros doing that, but I personally just don't believe it. I think that when you write these messages, when you write, you know, death to niggers, go Trump, swastika 2016, you know, you write that, and maybe you do, maybe you find it funny. But you find it funny. The joke to you is the fear and, you know, exclusion and hate. It's right. It's the message you're sending to the people you want to receive it. It's their feelings that are the joke to you. And so I think there's a different psychology to it. So, you know, so the people who are out there doing this, you know, this pro-Trump graffiti.
But these are the fascists.
These are dangerous. I think they're dangerous. They represent a fascistic spirit. I mean, look. We had a rally yesterday in Albany. We had a rally a couple 3 weeks before that. You know, somebody drove by and they yelled Trump, and I think you see this going around, that people yelling Trump,
and that's the argument too. That's minorities, it's like Trump.
Ultimately, you know, I mean, what I think is at play here, and I think this is, you know, in the '60s, you know, when Martin Luther King had his victories. What he ultimately achieved was a social consensus that saying the word nigger is racist. And since then, that's the bar. That's what, like, did you shout nigger in public at someone and then beat up a black person? Well, obviously, yep, we all agree. That's what the convention was. We all agreed to call that kind of thing.
And cops can beat up black people,
yeah,
as long as they don't shout.
That, you know, when you wear a KKK outfit and burn a cross and yell, niggers go home, yep. That's racism. We all agree that these, like,
systematic
only
forms
the most overt kinds of racism are racism. And we see, again, we see this locally with the Defend Black Girls UAlbany. You know, that's an incident where, right, these girls allege that they got that the whole fight was racially motivated, or was begun with the usage of racial slurs and and such.
Or and class, maybe it was again, class motivated. The, just like the white
establishment's response essentially has been: we didn't hear anyone say nigger. Ergo, this isn't a hate crime. Ergo, nothing racial is happening. Exactly. And so we're at a point now because yelling Trump is the way to yell nigger at someone, right? And I think that's the place where we are. Right? I think people know people. The people who are
certainly
saying
seems
this,
to be as emotionally satisfying to them.
Exactly. And I think that the payoff works because on some level in their mind, they do understand the connection between what Donald Trump has been saying and the unconscious, in their minds anyway, institutions of white supremacy. They get those things. They get that that's what Donald Trump stands for. That's why they vote for him. Yeah. And they know the fear that minority communities feel because of Donald Trump's election. And causing that fear, right, that's why you say Trump to those people. That's what gives it the emotional charge, is that you want, right? And so for the same way...
Yeah, even if you're like, not drawing the swastika correctly, it still inspires that this
And I think that's the terrorism. Other, that's the other, to me, really big takeaway of this wave of hate crimes. There is a shitload of really shittily drawn swastikas. And I'm just a little bit surprised, you know?
I've seen them before.
They're just like really poor. I mean, they're just poor.
Not in person, by the way.
I've seen this just shitty ones. I mean, what is going on with, you know, the fascists nowadays? They don't even draw their own symbols terribly well. And I think that's just deplorable. I mean, get your shit together. I would respect you even slightly more if you even could do fascism not half-assedly.
I think it speaks to that they're working on pure emotion. They haven't read anything about fascism or the Nazi ideology. Or if they have, it was a blog post or someone's tweet. And it's just these comments with feelings attached to them, you know. But it goes to the kind of deeper conversation about, like, you know, who are Trump voters? And, you know, the surface level that's dumb and always is when it's a binary of either they were economically motivated or they were racially motivated. Deeper, you know, is to say, well, they're both, you know, and or it's not one or the other. And then level deeper again, what you speak to and is what I would speak to is that they're linked inequivocally. That the economic system, over a course of American history, mind you, I'm not talking like the recent Tech Valley economy. I'm talking about the entire American system is founded on white, you know, it's been white supremacy.
It is white supremacy.
So yeah, so when we say we need to take down white supremacy, we're also you're saying at the same time we need to take down this economy or at least transform it. And that's something that progressives, liberals, or at least the Democratic Party, I'll just use that as a catch-all, Democratic Party will never, you know, admit, and there's a denial there. And that's why it's like, look, if you really care about race relations and sexism and fighting that shit, we have to go after these foundational problems and the foundational truth that they're one and the same. And that's what I hear from other leftists that I like. Hearing too, and they're my comrades because they will say, you know, intersectionality means that attacking one is attacking all of them, and denying that is what weakens whatever effort you do, whether it's be marching, holding your rally, you know, and that was kind of a weakness I saw. I mean, I couldn't make it for personal reasons. But I heard, you know, the mayor spoke there and kind of gave her a little whatever spiel on, are we a sanctuary city? Are we going to be one? How important is that? No, I don't see any real change in policy.
Sheehan came down and gave a whole thing about Albany PD are not going to ask anybody for their, you know, immigration status. But, you know.
What about when they're actually jailed?
That will do, you know, that would have done Dante Ivey a shitload of good. You know what I mean? Yeah, thank God they would. The next person they stop, they won't ask for their immigration status. Then when they fucking shoot them to death, you know what I mean? Like,
And an activist pointed out that a lot of the deportations and the mass, you know, whatever Trump is going to do, it's going to be on the county level with the sheriffs. That when people are arrested in the county system, then they're going to do an immigration check. And then deport everybody who, like, you know, and it's not a matter of they're arrested because of an actual criminal. It's you criminalize people by mass arresting people and then doing the check, you know, and then send them somewhere after. And that's step three, you know, even if, say, the crime is literally some quality of life crime or just a random drug offense or any kind of small offense. And that's a different conversation about crime, punitive justice system and whatever. But at least on the level of if you want to actually stop the Trump mass deportation, it's there. You know, it happens on that level as it currently does. Because a lot of people don't understand immigration issues, ICE. No one knows what ICE is. ICE is the federal agency that's basically the Gestapo of America.
Here in Albany, you know, with Craig Apple as sheriff, nothing is going to change anyway until we get rid of him. You know, and so that's, you know, that again, I think that's, to me, the lesson here in this election for the left, the big takeaway is that it's time to get organized and it's time to take power locally. It's time to, again, you know, start taking over the city council, you know.
Amen.
You know, get, like, I mean, one Kashama Sawant is great. 1,000 Kashama Sawants is better. You know, I look forward to the day when the entire Albany City Council is you know, socialists, or, you know,
and most of our budget goes to
participatory budgeting plans and, you know, urban gardens and, you know, funding for the libraries,
right? Alternative currency, perhaps public bank, but yeah,
all kinds of different schemes we can come up with,
all kinds of things we can debate, but they're not in the conversation is the point. The conversation is about trash taxes and how high did the taxes go up.
Yeah, the conversation is not—it's not where it needs to be. That we don't Albany, like most other regions in this country, we just—they don't have any. You know, there's very little real alternative to the two machine parties, to the, you know, to the duopoly, and that's, you know, ultimately that.
Well, the two machines within the Democratic
Party. Short of, you know, social revolution, pitchforks in hand, you know, seizing the mechanisms of state power is. You know, that's the goal. You know, I'm very willing to be, you know, bad guy Lenin in the many leftist circles, you know, where he is not popular. And, you know, that's what our goal should be. It's seizing power. You know, that's everyone on the left these days likes to
clarify that you identify as.
As what? I identify as a Marxist. I identify as.
Anything else?
No, I'm identified as a Marxist. Okay.
General, cool.
Yeah, I don't, you know.
Just want to get that out with anyone I have on, and of course myself, which I'll, you know, it changed, but otherwise I say left libertarian.
I try to be simple, you know, evocative. If it weren't for, you know, Communist Party USA, I would say I'm communist. And people who know me, I say communist, but people who don't know, I don't say communist. People who don't, I don't want them to think that I'm affiliated with CPUSA. You know, they're essentially functionaries of the Democrat. I mean, they're so attached to the Democrats that I don't know really what is technically, what is like communist about them at all.
It's so strange because it's like that their very existence now is just to lead credence to neocons or what have you, or the Glenn Becks of the world, to call the Democrats communists. Because the communists will then say, act like Democrats.
You know, the CPUSA participates in, they do most of their work through the Working Families Party, which is a coalition of, like, you know, fringe groups attached.
So that's how it works.
That are essentially attached to the Democratic Party, you know.
Yes.
And the communists, I mean, really, I think the communists are there, and the Democrats, a lot, you know, want them around because it proves how, quote, inclusive the Democrats are. That, like, even the communists, you know, we embrace everyone.
Our hegemony is all power.
Even the communists can work. Even they can work within our system. But, like, they're not really. I don't think CPUSA is terribly revolutionary. I mean,
No, and I think
they're
irrelevant to guys like us.
They've been neutered since, you know, McCarthy.
McCarthy, what, you know, yeah, the McCarthy era. All right, but that's a different thing. I think we've gone a good amount of time. Is there anything you'd like to end on, or any last ending topic that we could wrap up with? I should end with like a solution kind of thing, like we mentioned participatory budgeting.
Yeah,
give a little blurb on that. So I guess that's what we'll do. Participatory budgeting is, and I'll put it really the bite-sized version is, imagine pork barrel spending, but instead of being in the hands of a representative with their own motive or donors, which will, you know, then temper where that money goes, it's given over to a democratic process. The usual way it's done, at least in New York City, which is kind of a good model, is it's like it starts with $1 million, which is on a, it would be, a, let's say in Albany, it would be $1 million. And it would go. It would be for like infrastructure spending, but then how it's spent is left up to a series of committees that are volunteer. It's basically you have an assembly, people, you know, public meeting. People come in, they shout out their ideas, and I've done this before, but it didn't lead to a breakout group or any kind of process. So that would be the next thing to do. So then they make proposals, and then by the end of the year. Particularly on election day, you have a separate ballot for all of these infrastructure proposals, like 20 of them, and people vote on a ranked choice kind of thing for their favorites, and then the top five get funded, no strings attached.
Yeah, that's. I mean, there's many different ways to, you know, organize. Started in Brazil. It's been utilized in India. It's been utilized in plenty of places around the world. It's a system that works. It increases democratic participation on kind of the part of the public. It allows the public to channel, you know, their own tax money towards the, you know, the needs that they have in their neighborhoods. It's, you know, it would be a real step on the way towards, you know, a real democratic and participatory economy. And
it's better than the grant system where you have to form your committee in an organization first, which takes years. Especially build up like your volunteer force. So in this way, your commitment does not have to be as strong as founding your own group that has to meet every month and so on and have its own bylaws and budget. It's a lot of work to do all of that, and it prevents a lot of people. Or you basically end up with this alphabet soup of groups that all might, they have very similar missions, they just maybe have different like goals, or at least that project that they'd want funded is different, and thus they need a completely different group to do that. Imagine if it was just one group or one process that is city led or at least city funded at the very least, and that's my definition of government, that or the best kind of government is that it provides access to common resources and then makes them available democratically and then lets things fly. So thank you for joining us, and thank you, Nick, for being with us. I hope to have you again. This was really fun, really good conversations, and let's keep that going. Thank you very much for joining with us, and you raise hell or bust.
Occupy, shut it down. New York is the people's town.